Welcome to The Brink, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. Radio Shack, a little old place where we could get electronics, went ham, and became a hobbyist mecca.
But that billion-dollar company couldn't focus its interests and delved into many projects to try to stay cutting edge.
This, along with a rotating door of CEOs, put a major kink in their cable, leading them to not one, but two bankruptcies sprinting to stay afloat.
Find out how on Radio Shack, On the Brink.
Hey guys, I'm Jonathan.
And I'm Ariel, and I apologize. That was a little bit of a weaker intro than I normally
but
write.
When I saw that intro, I was just like, well, this is clearly Love Shack. I'm
going
to have to do a Fred Schneider.
It was. I didn't set myself up to continue the joke.
Yeah. No, that's fair. That's fair. And also, we are based out of Atlanta, so we have a particular affinity for B-52s.
Yes. Yes. I was going to be like, hey, I'm radio. Lost it.
Well, we are not talking about B-52s today.
No.
I wish we were, because that would be rock and roll. But we're talking about Radio Shack, a company I remember well because, you know, I grew up in the 1980s mall culture, and there was a Radio Shack in just about every mall. And I have lots of memories of going into those places and looking around and thinking, I should really want to buy stuff in here, but I can't find things I want to buy because turned out I didn't have any needs for diodes or anything.
Yeah, they had a niche market, and then they had a bizarre market, and then they had no market, and we'll get into that. But before we do, I just want to say that this is another listener suggestion.
Oh, who asked for this one?
Yes, Sarah Rosenbaum asked for this one.
All right, excellent. So, Sarah, this is the story of Radio Shack, and we're going to give you a quick down and dirty rundown of the history. So it was founded in 1921 in Boston. In fact, that's where it stayed for 40 years.
Yeah.
It was just in Boston. There were a couple of brothers, Theodore and Milton Deutschman, who created the store. And they were, you know, it was kind of they had come out of the catalog retail business.
They were selling surplus items, largely radio pieces from they had gotten from the Army, Army pieces. So they were just a single store. And then they started selling. They really didn't release their first official catalog till a while after they started, but they were still mail ordering pieces.
Yeah, and they were mostly focused on ham radios, as the intro suggested, not like, you know, your standard transistor radio. Transistors weren't a thing yet in 1920. So these were the sort of radio sets you would set up at home and use to broadcast and receive from other ham radio operators, a lot of amateur radio operators.
Yeah.
So, you know, to put this in perspective, Boston got its first commercial radio station in 1921, the same year that Radio Shack opened. So commercial radio was not really a thing yet. There had been some amateur radio enthusiasts who had been broadcasting on limited licenses, but licensed commercial radio was just starting to become a thing. So different era.
Yeah, and they were really focused towards those hobbyists and making this hobby more accessible to everyone, kind of like Kodak did with their cameras. But the thing is, at the time, there weren't really many stores doing this. Not only were radios cutting edge, but this whole electronics hobby thing was also kind of new. So they were a front runner in this business at the time.
It was also kind of hard to sustain because you're talking about a niche market already, right? Yeah. Like you're catering to, by definition, a small group of people. So building and maintaining a business on top of that was challenging.
I mean, they did well for a little while, but it was small. In fact, as I said before, they didn't issue their catalog for a while. It wasn't until 1939 that their first official catalog came out.
Mm-hmm.
And over the next couple of decades, they only grew their stores to like nine. They only had nine stores.
Yeah, all in the Boston area.
Mm-hmm.
And they were opening up to other areas of electronics as they were coming onto the market.
Which is smart.
Yep. They added music as one of the things they were offering, which makes sense because this is right around the same time that you started getting things like not just the radio sets that were meant to just pick up the commercial radio stations, but also things like gramophones, things like that, you know, things that could play recorded music.
Trying to keep up with the change in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the 50s, Radio Shack started selling private label products. And this is something that they would toy with over the years, just creating their own versions of whatever the hot new tech item was, mm-hmm. or pieces to make your own version of the hot new tech item. And by the early 60s, they were a leader in the market. So they were a front runner, but they really made a niche for themselves. But then they made a mistake. Mm-hmm. And I can't even say that I would say, looking at it, that you could know it was a mistake. They offered credit in their store.
So it was only a mistake in hindsight, as they offered credit at their stores, but then found it very difficult to collect upon debts owed to them.
But Macy's did fine with credit, so.
Yeah, so they were in deep financial trouble by the early 1960s, and that's when a guy named Charles Tandy, the leader of the Tandy Corporation, sweeps in to purchase the company.
Yeah, for a whole $300,000.
Yeah, and this is still 9 stores in Boston. And the Tandy Corporation, people who were around in the 80s might think of Tandy Computers. That is, in fact, the same company. But
I think of Tandy Leather.
That's exactly what it started off as.
Yeah,
they were a leather company. So it's kind of one of those stories where you had a company that was specialized in a particular product and then diversified to almost a ludicrous degree. Charles Tandy was determined to really diversify the company's holdings. Radio Shack was just one of many purchases.
He wanted to be the Disney of retail, it sounds like.
Yeah, and he ended up buying like Dillard's and Pier 1 and a couple of other types of stores as well during the same era. And he also wanted to really scale up. Like, he wanted to build Radio Shack well outside of the Boston area.
And he did. They not only increased their numbers of stores drastically, which is something that would come back and bite Radio Shack in the proverbial butt later.
Yep.
But also in expanding what they offered. So still trying to stay current with the market and catch whatever those trends coming down the line were.
Right. So 1975, the Tandy Corporation ends up selling off all of its non-electronics businesses. So they de-diversify, but they focus on electronics.
Yeah.
Now, this is the era where they would start to dip their toe in the brand new, in fact, not even established market of personal computers.
I want to say a quick aside. They sold off all of their non-electronic businesses, but I still go to Tandy Leather occasionally, so
okay.
It's still out there.
Yes, it is still out there. Yes.
Sorry, I just had to put that aside.
All right, well, back to Radio Shack.
Okay.
Come on, we're not talking about Tandy in this episode.
Well, we kind of are.
A little bit.
All right, so yeah, in the 80s, they developed personal computers, and they actually started a little earlier than the 80s. They started in 1977 is when their first computer came out. It was the TRS-80.
Mm-hmm.
And it sold better than the Apple computer of the time. It was just at the beginning of personal computers.
Yeah, they were really pioneers in the space for personal computers. Before this, you had hobby kits that would be sold to hobbyists, but that by definition, really limited who could buy it. Because it's only people who felt confident that they could wire one together.
Yeah, but electronic hobbies was Radio Shack niche. So it made sense that they would delve into, well, if you want to build a computer, but you don't know how, here's a computer.
Yeah, here's a fully assembled machine that you can purchase right now, and you can have your own personal computer. The TRS-80 is affectionately called the Trash 80.
Despite selling over 200,000 of them.
Yeah, there were issues with that computer, and there would also be issues with Radio Shack's PC strategy, and we'll touch on that now and again throughout this episode.
Also, by the 80s, they were up to thousands of stores from the original 9.
Mm-hmm.
And in 81, they got a new CEO.
Yeah, the Tandy had passed away in the 70s, and then their interim CEO left, and so in 81 they get their new one.
But this is also the time where they start hitting a stalling point, because now their computer, which had issues but was still selling, was being outclassed by IBM and Dell.
On the startup side, they had Apple to fight with and mm-hmm. Dell, and then on the established side, you had IBM. They were kind of caught in the middle, and they weren't innovative enough to stand out like Apple did,
mm-hmm.
and they weren't established enough in the PC space, or the computer space, I should say, that they could really compete with IBM. IBM had sort of the business side, like for all small and medium and large businesses, those companies went to IBM for their computers. And then home users, more and more people were either going with Commodore or Apple.
Man, I had a Commodore. At this time, they pushed their goals for computer sales down to less than 10% of their sales.
Yeah, they figured that the writing was on the wall and that if they dedicated too much of their effort toward trying to sell these computers, they would ultimately just be hurting their bottom line. So yeah. it was almost like, let's sell what we have left, but let's not focus on that as our primary revenue source.
And this led to a restructure in 1991 to shift gears and to really try to go into more mainstream electronics for them.
Now, we'll talk more about how that effort actually turned out in just a moment. But first, let's take a quick break. All right, let's backtrack just a bit, Ariel. We had just mentioned before the break that in the early 90s, that would lead to a restructuring of their businesses. But in 1984, we have an example of Radio Shack getting into a specific area of electronics that would become both important to the company and ultimately down the road, kind of an albatross around the company's proverbial neck.
Yeah. So in 84, they sold their first home phone. So they went into the phone industry, figuring that would be a big trend. And they also, the next year, went into satellite TV. Both of these things, they held on to for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
And the phones in particular would end up being kind of a weight around their neck. But they kept trying for it, and I don't know why. Really, at this time, Radio Shack is so desperate. And I feel like it was maybe a little bit sooner than they needed to be, and maybe the reason that they declined so much, they were so desperate to stay relevant that they just spread their net far and wide as to what they needed to do to make their company profitable and successful. Yeah. So they moved into cell phones. They moved into satellite TV. They opened up specialty stores like Computer City and Energy Express Plus, which sold batteries, and Incredible Universe, which is basically fries. And later on, when they closed all those, because that didn't work.
Yeah.
They sold off Incredible Universe to Fry's. Because when I was reading the description of how an Incredible Universe was set up, it was made to compete with Best Buy.
We used to have an Incredible Universe here in the Atlanta area. I take it you never went.
I never went, but I've been to Fry's. And so, I was like, well, this is the same layout.
So the Incredible Universe that was here in Atlanta, not only did they sell electronics and stuff, but, and this is a little side note, they had a recording booth where you could record yourself doing karaoke.
Oh, fun.
And they would actually burn it to disc or they'd actually even record it to cassette back in the day. And then you would have your own recording of you doing karaoke. And that's why somewhere floating around my house, there's a recording of me doing I Fought the Law and the Law Won as Fred Schneider from the B-52s.
I want to hear that. I went a little bit into how they diversified all these stores and how they eventually closed off. On the cell phone side of it, they moved into cell phones in 93. That caused a lot of problems because it tied up their employees in the registration process. If you've ever bought a cell phone, which I'm guessing most of our listeners have.
Yeah.
It takes a while to set up.
For the first time where you're actually establishing your phone number, you're establishing your account.
Which would be most people at that time.
Yeah. Back in the early 90s, that's when everyone's first doing. I mean, I didn't get one till the late 90s for me. But I remember distinctly, like, that was a long and involved process. If you're talking about stores that typically were fairly small and had, you know, a relatively small staff, maybe 3 or 4 people working the store at any given time, tying them up in a 45-minute process was a bit of a hindrance. And on top of that, and I'll talk more about this later in the episode too, at Radio Shack, salespeople were given an incentive by earning a commission on sales if they reached a certain amount per sale.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're tying up a salesperson for 45 minutes and that person also is counting on commissions to make up part of their compensation, that's got to be a stressful environment too. Because that's 45 minutes when you can't be selling other stuff to other people.
Well, and then that's 45 minutes. Other people who want to buy other stuff don't have somebody to help them find it.
Yeah.
Along with that, in 2004, they tried remote kiosks to sell their phones or other people's phones, like in Sam's Club and Target. And that didn't go very well. It started to, and then it fell apart. And then in 2015, when they were really in the mire. They did a partnership with Sprint, and that also didn't go well. So for over 20 years, they tried to make cell phones work, figuring that would be where their big market was. And it never seemed to work. It makes me wonder why they stuck with it for so long.
Yeah. Well, and part of it might have just been this misguided desire to try and counteract that trend they had where they weren't focusing on stuff, where they were taking that more, you know, widespread, wide net approach, where you're not giving any one part of your business a deep level of attention. It's just that they ended up picking perhaps the worst, worst of their many businesses to really focus on.
Yeah. So by 1999, after all of their spinoff stores had closed and they just had the original Radio Shacks, which were doing okay.
Yeah.
They kind of hit their peak.
Mm-hmm.
It was the best year for Radio Shack. And they opened their website quite a few years after Amazon came on the scene.
Yeah. Yeah. This is another one of those things that a lot of people point to. Like, if you do a web search for why did Radio Shack go bankrupt, there are usually 5 or 6 points that most of those articles really focus on. Mm-hmm. And we just talked about 2 of them. The cell phones are a big one. And then the late jump on the internet commerce side was another big one.
Well, and even in 1999, it wasn't really commerce. You could, you could read press releases and you could find a store, but you couldn't buy anything.
Yeah. So even then they were like, they were even further behind because it would take time before they would start to offer any sort of online sales.
Yes. And then in 1999, they got a new CEO.
Yeah. And get used to that sentence.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, the CEO did something good. He did the store within a store model. So all the places you could buy your subscriptions had their own, like, little sections in Radio Shack, your satellite TV, your cell service, your internet. He was one of the first to do this. And in 2000, you know, things were going good. Tandy changed their name to the Radio Shack Corporation.
Yeah. So Tandy, at this point, is taking the identity of one of its subsidiaries, essentially. Mm-hmm. But Radio Shack was really facing stiff competition, not just online through Amazon, which was growing rapidly and starting to build upon its original business as an online bookstore mm-hmm. by offering other stuff, but also with the big box stores that were dominating the market.
Like Best Buy and
like
Walmart.
Best Buy, yeah. It was also tough because the general perception was that the stuff you could buy at Radio Shack was not different than the stuff you could buy at a lot of other places, but also was more expensive.
Yeah, they couldn't make up the price elsewhere like Walmart could or like Best Buy could.
Yeah, they didn't have loss leaders like mm-hmm. a lot of other stores did. So they tried to compensate that for that by having knowledgeable employees who could help guide customers for stuff that they needed. But that wasn't quite enough to counteract this problem.
Yeah. Another thing is because they were trying to compete with Best Buy, they ended up having this really weird mix of hobbyist pieces and periphery items and mm-hmm. then weird, obscure gadgets that nobody wanted to buy, like the QCAT barcode reader. It came up quite a few times in my research as something that they stocked a lot of and nobody knew why they needed it, so nobody mm-hmm. bought it.
Let's skip ahead a little bit further to 2005. That's when David Edmondson, who had been in Radio Shack since the 90s, he had held numerous positions, was the new CEO. He lasted for all of about a year at CEO because here's the problem when you become CEO. If, in fact, you haven't been completely upfront and honest about your background, you typically come under a lot of scrutiny when you're leading mm-hmm. a company. And as it turned out, Edmondson had not been totally honest on his resume.
No, he said he had a couple college degrees when he had none of those.
Yeah. And here's the thing is that this is not a story unique to Radio Shack. There actually are a few high-profile stories of executives who rose to a level where such fibs came back to haunt them. So someday, I think, for the Brink, we'll need to do an episode where we specifically cover that kind of thing and talk about some of the people who have infamously been forced to resign or chose to leave positions because it came to light that they were not entirely honest about their backgrounds.
I agree. But now back to Radio Shack.
Yes.
So in 2006, Radio Shack finally started their buy online, ship to store feature.
Yeah. Still not really competing with Amazon because with Amazon, they ship directly to the customer's home.
And now they're getting losses. So now they're also having to close stores, do corporate layoffs, and their stocks are starting to plummet.
Yeah.
Edmondson was replaced by an interim CEO, and that was just for a few months. And then Julian Day replaced that interim CEO and became CEO after having been a part of Kmart before.
Yeah.
He had a good track record of turning companies around. But
yeah, he had this reputation that he was able to really, you know, save companies that were struggling. But this was a particularly tough position to be in.
Well, and I guess it's kind of foreshadowing because Kmart didn't end up doing too well either.
Yeah.
So
then 2009 comes around and Radio Shack pulls a stunt that would end up making it sort of the butt of jokes for about 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a rebranding effort. What was Radio Shack proposing it do?
Change their name to The Shack, which when I hear, I think of The Love Shack. B-52s again.
Yeah, back to the B-52s. Yeah, but not everyone immediately thought of a little spot down the Atlanta highway. A lot of people thought that it just made it sound like it was kind of this shabby backwoods sort of business
that
to call
too.
It The Shack. This was also, by the way, the same time that Pizza Hut was toying with the idea of just becoming
The Hut.
Like Jabba. So, yeah, this ended up becoming, like I said, a punchline for a lot of different outlets. So if you do a search for Radio Shack and The Shack, you're going to get a whole bunch of articles from 2009, 2010 that are just mercilessly making fun of the company for trying to be hip and cool in what is considered to be a misguided attempt.
Yeah. So after that failed attempt at success, they have yet more CEO turnover. 2011, 2012, 2013 all had new CEOs. None of them were able to surmount the rising losses that Radio Shack was experiencing, which from 2012 on, that's all they experienced. They spent $2.6 billion since 2000 up until this time trying to purchase their own stock to bolster their share prices.
We usually save lessons toward the end, but sometimes we might as well go ahead and insert them in the middle of an episode. And here is one that we've talked about numerous times, right? The idea that if you have an unstable executive team, that spells really bad news for the rest of the company. And to not be able to establish a stable foundation for leadership, it's no surprise that the company was struggling.
Yeah.
If you can't keep the same CEO for more than a year, then as each person comes in and attempts to shape the corporation according to their own, you know, leadership style, all you have is just an unending period of trying to adjust.
Yeah.
And just as you're getting close to aligning with the leader's vision, they're gone and you've got someone else and the whole process starts over again.
Yes. Well, in 2013-14, they got yet another CEO. At the time, they had ended 2013 with a loss of $40 million.
Mm-hmm.
The CEO came in. He wanted to do another restructure, improve the management, improve the marketing, change up the store design to make it edgier and cleaner and brighter, to expand the products offered, with a goal of becoming profitable again by 2015.
Yeah.
Still holding on to those smartphones.
And this was the seventh CEO in 8 years.
Yes. This turnaround cost more than he expected, and they ended up having to take out loans.
Mm-hmm.
So they took out a $585 million line of credit from GE Capital, and then a $250 million term loan from Salus Capital. And you'd think that the bigger loan would be the problem, but it was actually the Salus Capital loan because it meant that they couldn't close any more than 200 stores in a year without getting permission.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a really bad holiday season and they needed to close stores. They needed to close about 1,000 of them. And Salus was saying no.
Yikes. So yeah. They were between a rock and a hard place, as they say.
And it would have been smart to close those stores because at the time they also had stores very close together. So they were competing with themselves. They were suffering from like a Starbucks syndrome.
Yeah, I have a note later on, but I might as well mention it here, that in Sacramento, California, in a 25 square mile area, they had 25 stores. So that's a store for every square mile.
Yeah.
That is a heavy concentration of Radio Shack stores. When you specifically think that this is a store that still largely is marketed toward hobbyists. I mean, if you ever went into a Radio Shack, you were looking at a lot of tiny little electronics parts. Mm-hmm. I mean, they had fully assembled stuff too, but they were mostly known for selling components.
It's more confusing than a Home Depot.
Yeah.
In February 2014, they tried to bump up their marketing by doing a Super Bowl commercial, and it cost them $4 million, but they didn't really explain in the commercial all of the changes that they had been trying to put into place. So consumers didn't really know why to give Radio Shack a chance.
So it was a $4 million expensive mistake.
Yeah, they didn't have the same success as Old Spice.
Yep. So by September 2014, they enjoyed the great success of that Super Bowl commercial. And by that, I'm being facetious, because they had posted a quarterly loss, the 10th consecutive quarterly loss. Mm-hmm. But this one was nearly $120 million. And worse than that, they were running very low on operating cash, to the point where it was quickly becoming evident that if something didn't change, they were not going to stay in business.
Yeah, their stock was barely above a dollar, which, as we know, is the threshold to stay on the NASDAQ.
Mm-hmm.
And Salas was still saying they couldn't close those stores to get any additional revenue in.
Yep.
And this is what leads up to bankruptcy, but we'll talk about that right after this break.
In 2015, Radio Shack is in really awful shape. They have defaulted on loans. They had a couple of really poor years in general and terrible holiday seasons in particular. They fall off the NASDAQ because their stock price finally drops below the threshold. And then without any other real options, they file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection.
Yeah, they had to close 2,400 stores. But then they were bought by one of their creditors, General Wireless Operations.
GWO.
Yes. And they took over running the remaining 1,500 stores. By this time, Radio Shack was only in the U.S. and Mexico. They had become more of an international market.
But they had to close those down as part of this long decline. In 2016, it looked at first like things might be turning around, right?
Yeah. General Wireless Operations seemed to be doing a good job. Their expenses dropped 23%. The profits were up 8%. But they had made a partnership with Sprint in 2015, as we had mentioned before, I believe, in an effort to share store space and kind of share markets.
Mm-hmm.
And that was eating up their profits. It wasn't as profitable for them as they wanted. And they actually filed a lawsuit in 2017 against Sprint for $500 million in damages because they said Sprint was using confidential information they got in making that partnership to basically open competing stores.
Wow.
Yeah.
And just cannibalizing this partnership that they had made with Radio Shack.
Sprint fought that allegation. I actually don't know how it turned out. Guessing in Sprint's favor. They did end up buying a bunch of the store space.
Mm-hmm. So Radio Shack had filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, emerged from bankruptcy after being bought by their creditor. And then in 2017, they filed for it again, which is unusual because typically companies are not allowed to file for bankruptcy twice in such a short period.
Yeah,
but there was an exception here.
Yeah, usually you're supposed to wait 7 to 10 years, or you have to wait 7 to 10 years, I guess. But because they were filing bankruptcy this time under the name GWO, they didn't have that restriction.
Yeah, it was technically a different company because you had a different owner. So at this point, it really got grim. Before they had closed all but 1,500 stores. This time they closed significantly more than that.
Yeah, they ended up with only 72 company stores by the end of this bankruptcy, which would be even less later on as they continue to try to fight this.
Yeah, they did have relationships with stores that had essentially licensed the ability to operate as Radio Shack. These were dealer stores. There were around 500 of those.
Yeah, and but some of them still exist.
Yeah, but they didn't own those. Yeah, the Radio Shacks you see today, those are the licensed entities that have essentially paid to operate under Radio Shack.
But here's the crazy thing. This seems like a drop you can't come back from, but Radio Shack exited bankruptcy a second time in January 2018.
Mm-hmm.
Despite the fact that I bet half the people out there wouldn't be able to tell you what Radio Shack is.
Yeah.
They are technically still around and technically out of bankruptcy. Now they're owned by Kensington Capital Holdings. And they're hoping to make a gross revenue of $17.5 million by 2020.
So these days, they're really focusing on online stores. Mm-hmm. So they've got an online store, and then they have this relationship with the independent dealers who are operating under the Radio Shack name, but they are independent. It's not like the company owns those stores.
They do have semi stores now.
Yeah, they have stores within other stores.
Yeah, kind of the way that Toys R Us came back as little kiosks.
Yes. Yeah. So, looking back at some of the lessons, we've talked about a few of them. The idea that the company had a lack of focus, and mm-hmm. because it was trying so many different things, it wasn't doing any of them particularly well.
And I feel like they jumped the shark on that. Like, they started freaking out before things really got bad.
I feel like they probably could have made a better run at the personal computer space in particular if they had a chance to really invest in that. But I think they saw where the competition was and decided that they didn't want to have to fight in that same space because it was going to be really fierce fighting. The early Tandy computers did have a reputation for being somewhat, let's say, quirky. But
people like quirky.
Yeah. Well, they could have come back from that. I know people who really genuinely loved the Tandy computer. But for a lot of people, it's like you're loving it despite its faults kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But they weren't able to stick around with it long enough to really make a huge dent in that. And then, you know, the fact that the business started off as something that focused on hobbyists ultimately limited itself. In fact, that's where you can find a lot of Radio Shack mini stores are in hobbyist stores now.
In hobby towns, I think they're called, is primarily where, which I had never heard of Hobby Town.
No, yeah, I have. I've been in hobby towns.
Another problem, as we talked about, is how many stores they open. So Tandy expanded the company, but he didn't really take into account regions.
Yeah, there was not enough strategy applied to the expansion. We've seen this story multiple times, right? Where we've seen stories about how stores would open up and they would end up competing with themselves because mm-hmm. you would have locations that were so close to each other that rather than add to the revenue you're generating in that region, you're really just adding to the cost of operation because you're not getting more customers. The customers are just going to one store or the other. So instead of doubling your customers, you have the same number, but you have twice the costs. And that was a real problem throughout many regions that Radio Shack was operating in. Like I mentioned Sacramento, but that was just one example.
Yeah. And then the online sale thing.
Yeah. The fact that they waited too long to get into that. I wrote in the notes that they got Radio Shackled.
The thing is, I wonder if they had jumped on that bandwagon sooner, if they had come out with a website, because they're dealing with electronics. They should have been able to come out with a website that worked decently. If they had done that around the time that Amazon was getting its presence, mm-hmm. maybe the loyal customers Radio Shack had would have stayed with them because they'd be more convenient. And by the time they could get the stuff on Amazon for cheaper, they'd already have their accounts set up on Radio Shack and it would just be easier.
That's possible. It's hard to say because between then and now, we also had the dot-com bubble burst.
Yeah.
So granted, Radio Shack would have been coming at this from an established company perspective, not from a startup that suddenly owed a huge amount of money to investors.
They did well in the bubble.
Yeah, they were all right. They lasted through that time, largely because they weren't in that space.
Yeah.
I also mentioned the fact that salespeople were partly compensated on commission. This also earned Radio Shack a reputation for having pushy staff because they were trying to upsell customers and get, like, they were only earning commissions if the sales were hitting a certain amount per customer. Mm-hmm. So if it was under that threshold, you didn't get a commission for that sale. So there was an incentive to get people to buy more stuff so that you would hit those goals and you would get a commission on the sale. So if you never walked into a Radio Shack during those days, the experience was like this. You walk in, immediately someone swoops in. Can I help you? And you're like, I'm just looking, thanks. And you're looking around for whatever. And then you take two steps. Someone else swoops it. Can I help you? Because everyone wants to try and get the commission on that sale. Totally understandable. Like, it was a strategy to motivate the sales force, but it created an experience for the customer that was suboptimal. So while it motivated the sales force to try and move more product and thus create more revenue, you were alienating the customer base. And that was a problem, especially mm-hmm. as online was growing, because people were like, oh, I don't have to deal with that crap if I go online.
Yeah.
No one bugs me. I search for it in the search bar and then I click a little link and I buy it then and I'm done.
Yeah, and they didn't really have stable management to help push any revitalization projects through.
Yeah, there were a lot of start and stops because you'd have people with big ideas come in, but they wouldn't last long enough to actually see it all the way through, and then it would be back to the drawing board with the next person. So a lot of lessons to learn here.
It's hard to talk about because they went in so many different directions. You're like, where do I even start?
Well, and it's also complicated because of the connection to Tandy, which is its own, like we can do another Brink episode about Tandy, which technically ties directly into Radio Shack. I mean, Tandy and Radio Shack are synonymous by the end of it. You know, there are other parts of Tandy's journey that would tell us more stories that are more valuable lessons.
So I do have one fun fact.
What's that?
To end this episode, because it was a pretty long descent into the Brink.
Yes. they were on the Brink and then they fell down, but they kept hitting stuff all the way down. So it took a while to hit the bottom.
Doing the goofy woohoo all the way down.
So what's your fun fact?
All right. So their item that was in production the longest was the Flavor Radio. It was in production from 1972 through 2001, the same design, which is not a radio that if you lick it, it tastes like different fruits, sadly.
The Snozzberry station tastes like Snozzberries.
When I read it, I was like, a Flavor Radio? Is this like gummy radios and you eat them? No, they were just multicolored portable radios, kind of a precursor to the Walkman or the iPod.
Okay, cool. Yeah. I never had heard of that. So I learned something today.
Cheap pocket-sized transistor radios.
Cool. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Brink. We look forward to hearing more from you guys. So if you have any suggestions for other show topics that we should cover, you should contact us. How would they do that, Ariel?
Well, they would do that by emailing us at feedback@thebrinkpodcast.show.
Yep. And you can go to our website. That's thebrinkpodcast.show. You will find an archive of all of our episodes and more information about your beloved hosts. And that's it for this episode. So I guess until next time, I am Jonathan Strickland.
And I'm Ariel Kasten. The Brink is a production of iHeartRadio and How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.